It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, you can have your groceries, a new TV, an entire new wardrobe of clothing delivered to your home without a lot of hassle. But starting back in the early 1900s, you could order an entire house to be delivered in parts and pieces. We'll talk to an architectural historian about the history of mail order homes here in Wisconsin and beyond. First, the state legislature will meet for an extraordinary session starting November 12th to consider an incentive package for paper manufacturer Kimberly-Clark. In January, the company announced worldwide cutbacks, ultimately that included plans to close plants in Neenah and Fox Crossing. Lawmakers backed by Governor Walker put together a state incentive plan to keep those jobs in Wisconsin, at least some of them. The legislation passed the state assembly in February, but still hasn't passed the Senate. Laurel White has been following the story. She's WPR state capitol reporter. Laurel, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
All right, so this was announced today, this extraordinary session. What's supposed to happen at this?
So the extraordinary session has been called by Senator Scott Fitzgerald, who's the leader of the state Senate, and Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, who leads the assembly. And basically what they're saying is lawmakers are going to come back, specifically state senators, for this Kimberly-Clark deal. So it can go through committee and then go to the Senate floor and be voted on at that point.
We've talked to you about this before, but run us through the basics. What is involved in this incentive package?
So this is a, they call it a Foxconn-style deal. That's what the governor has called it. He's the one that proposed it. They call it that because it's based on the same percentages of tax incentives. So it would be a 17% payroll tax credit and a 15% capital expenditure tax credit, which would basically come in the form of a check to Kimberly-Clark, because the company doesn't have any tax liability right now based on the state tax code. So these are financial incentives the state would pay the company as a motivation to not close their Fox Crossing facility, which employs about 500 people.
Right. That's the cost side of things. The benefit, the hope for benefit, is that at least one of those factories then would stay open, an important part of the economy in the Fox Cities area.
Absolutely. And we have, according to Senator Fitzgerald, gotten some feedback from the company, or lawmakers have, that the Neenah facility is going to close. And that employs about 110 people. But the Fox Crossing facility, which has about 500 jobs, is still up for saving by this incentive package.
We already had a deadline from Kimberly-Clark that said, okay, state lawmakers, arrive at a deal by X date. I think it was the end of last month, right? Or we're done now. Are they saying, okay, we can wait for this session?
Yes. So I spoke with Senator Roger Roth this morning, and he's the sponsor of the bill that was introduced in the Senate that has the governor's proposal in it. And he said that they've had ongoing discussions with Kimberly-Clark. They reached out to the company as lawmakers and said, this is a very politically tricky thing to accomplish before the November 6th election. We would really like to get this done for you, but we feel like it needs to happen after the election. So he says the company was amenable to that, and they've agreed to extend the deadline until lawmakers are able to vote on the package, which, because it has to go through committee and then go to the Senate floor, would probably be mid to late November. The extraordinary session itself is called for around November 12th. And so there are a couple steps that would have to happen after that before it could be voted on by the whole Senate.
Laurel White's with us, WPR State Capitol reporter, looking at this extraordinary session that's been called for after the midterm elections to consider Kimberly-Clark incentive deals. Laurel, what is it about after Election Day that might make this easier to pass the Senate than before? Are senators looking over their shoulders right now trying to figure out, is it better for me to vote for or against this as I'm getting voted on?
So what Senator Roth told me this morning is that he doesn't have, or Republican leaders in the state Senate do not have, enough Republican votes to pass the package. They need 17 votes in order to pass it from the Senate. And a number of Republicans have come out against the deal for, you know, kind of a handful of different reasons. So they need Democrats to come on board to get this through. And Roth says that no Democrats have said they will vote yes on the package right now. And he thinks that's because the election is coming up in just a few weeks. and that they don't want to give Governor Walker a, you know, quote unquote win before the November 6th election. So he's optimistic that if they hold it after the election, more Democrats are going to be open to coming on board and getting this through the Senate.
The deal so far is that the Assembly passed their package, and the leadership in the Assembly says, Senate, if you come back into a session, take it or leave it. You do exactly what we did and pass along to the governor. We're not coming back. But mm-hmm. it sounds like you said with this extraordinary session, the Assembly could hypothetically come back and maybe consider changes.
So they could, because it's being the extraordinary session is being called by Assembly and Senate leaders. The Assembly can come back as well. I asked Senator Roth, because he is the sponsor, about whether they're anticipating any changes to the Kimberly-Clark package when it is taken up by the Senate. And he said, no, they're planning to take up what the Assembly passed, not make any changes to it. And so it would be kind of quick, easy, simple. They pass it, it's concurred in, it goes to the governor. But the Associated Press did ask Assembly Speaker Robin Voss today, when he was at a luncheon here hosted by WisPolitics in Madison, whether the Assembly would be open to taking up something else other than Kimberly-Clark when it reconvenes, or when it could reconvene for an extraordinary session. And Speaker Voss said that the Assembly might take up some other stuff. He said he'd be open to considering other legislation, according to the Associated Press, particularly a bill related to guaranteeing health coverage for people with pre-existing conditions in Wisconsin, which is an issue, of course, that a lot of candidates are talking about right now on the campaign trail. So as if Kimberly-Clark isn't interesting enough, we could get kind of some bonus bills at this November extraordinary session, potentially.
Well, I'll throw a hypothetical at you, Laurel. It is mm-hmm. possible that Republicans could keep control of the legislature next year. If so, then they don't need to do much. It's possible they could lose control of the Senate or the Assembly or the governor's office. That could be an opportunity for a lame duck session to pass some things before they lose control when people are sworn in January.
Absolutely. That's an option, or a hypothetical that was brought up actually by the Democratic minority leader in the Assembly today at that same event here in Madison. He said that Republicans, if they're, you know, if Tony Evers, for example, defeats Governor Walker in the governor's race, Republicans are going to come in that lame duck session and attempt to pass some bills while they still have the governor's office and majorities in both houses of the Assembly and the Senate. So it would be kind of a unique opportunity for them, if the election doesn't go as planned, to get some final things done that they might want to get done that might be a little bit more difficult to do after the inauguration in January.
You mentioned that Robin Voss on the Assembly side said he might be open to some other legislation apart from Kimberly-Clark. Have we heard anything from Republican Senate leadership along those lines?
So the leader of the state Senate, Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald, did tell the Associated Press this morning that he is not planning for the Senate to take up any other legislation that's not related to Kimberly-Clark. So, of course, for anything to make its way to the governor and become law, both chambers would have to take up a bill. Now, they could take up a bill that had been passed previously by the other house in the legislative session that wrapped up several months ago. So that's a little bit of a caveat. I don't believe that they have to take up things again. So we could have some issues arise that we thought were quote unquote, you know, we call them dead bills. We thought that they were maybe a dead bill for the legislative session. Those could come back in November. So it could be a pretty interesting month here in Wisconsin.
Laurel, thanks a lot for bringing us up to speed today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Laurel White is WPR's state capitol reporter. She was with us to talk about news that the state legislature will meet the week after midterm elections to consider an incentive package for Kimberly-Clark. Now, starting back in 1906, you could order an entire house in the mail. Mail order homes, which would be delivered unassembled like an IKEA product today, were offered by a lot of companies, including Sears and Montgomery Ward. And if you know what to look for, you might be able to spot one in your neighborhood today. Rebecca Hunter is an architectural historian. She's been hunting for these houses for 20 years. She's written books including Putting Sears Homes on the Map and Mail Order Homes. Rebecca, welcome to Central Time.
I'm glad to be here, Rob.
Well, what first got you curious about these mail order houses?
It has to do with my having been a researcher since I was 12 years old. And so the first thing I did when I moved to Elgin, Illinois, and bought a historic bungalow, I ran to the library to research bungalows. And totally by chance, or I guess thanks to the Dewey Decimal System, really, right next to the bungalow books on the library shelf was a little book called Houses by Mail. And I pulled that off the shelf, and I said, what a funny name for a book. And it turned out to be a book about the Sears Roebuck mail order houses. And so I kind of got hooked on it. And, so that was the very beginning. So and I renewed it about three times because it was out of print. And one cold day in February 1997, it was February 9th, you know, this is a historic moment, right? It's a bitterly, bitterly, bitterly cold day, bright blue sky and sunshine, and I need to go for my daily walk, and it's so cold. And I didn't want to go for a walk, but I saw that book on my dining room table, and I kind of laughed, and I picked up the book, and I said, oh, ha-ha, I wonder if I could walk around my own neighborhood and find one of these.
And did you? Did you find a mail-order house?
So the joke on me is most of the mail-order homes, the highest sales years were 1928 and 29. Most of them were marketed in the 20s, and I live in a 1920s neighborhood in an industrial town that had major growth in the 20s. And that had three railroad lines going through here, and it's 40 miles from Chicago. So the real question is, how could I not find one of these in my own neighborhood?
Now,
yes.
I looked at pictures of these online, and to the untrained eye, which means my eye, I couldn't look at a house and tell you if it was a mail order house or not. Can you generally, walking in a neighborhood, look and say, oh, yep, that's one of those?
Well, I'll tell you what, if you are able to train your eye to notice what I call picky architectural detail, right, then you are able to match houses with their images in the catalog. However, this is not proof that they really are what they look like, because, in fact, mail order companies were never interested in unique architectural design. They were interested in selling the maximum number of each model that they published in their catalog. So what did they say to their architect? They said, what are they buying this year? Make some. And so the mail order designs are very close copies of the popular styles from any given year.
Oh.
So overall, no, they don't look any different at all. But if you'd care to notice things like, you know, where is the dormer? Is it off the ridgepole? Is it in the middle? Is it down near the eave line? If you'd care to notice how many inches of space between the eaves and the tops of the windows, for example, if you'd care to estimate the outside dimensions, you know. When we do a physical search, what we're looking for is houses that match catalog images in every little particular.
Huh.
So and this means once you get your eye trained and once you have a collection of 100 catalogs to train your eye with, if you're crazy like some of us, you can drive up and down streets and cities all over the country and you could say, oh, hey, that looks like a Gordon Van Tine house there. And you can write down the address and what model you think it is and take some pictures, and then you can go back home and fine-tune it looking at your pictures in the catalogs. But in most cases, that's about where we have to start to look for mail-order houses, is with a physical street-by-street search, because only one of the eight major companies that sold mail-order houses still has any of their sales records available. So we can't just go to Ward's, which doesn't exist anymore. Actually, none of the companies exist anymore except for Sears. So we can't go to Sears and say, hey, give us your sales list of houses, because they don't have it. And so the good starting point is to actually do street-by-street searches.
We're talking about the history of mail order houses with Rebecca Hunter, an architectural historian. She's been researching and writing about these mail order houses. Rebecca, I want you to take us back to the heyday. You said it was the 1920s. Suppose I'm a, I don't know, young factory worker, just moved to Elgin. I found a plot of land. I want to order a house. What do I do?
Well, you've heard from your neighbors who are very happy with their mail order houses that they saved a whole bunch of money by ordering a pre-cut kit rather than hiring an architect to design a unique home and then hiring contractors and carpenters to put it up for you. Customers estimate that they saved one-third of the cost of traditional building by getting a catalog house. Now, your savings were mostly in labor, because the pre-cut catalog houses, the only difference between those houses and standard construction was that all your framing boards, that's the studs, the risers, the treads, the joists, you know, all of the framing boards, the skeleton of the house, those boards were pre-cut at the mill. And so you did not have to pay a carpenter to measure and cut every board. So, and then you also, because you didn't have to buy standard size lumber and cut it down, you didn't end up with a whole pile of scrap that you paid for and you couldn't use. So that was where you saved your one-third of the cost or whatever it actually came out to be. So I think you would, you know, you could get some mail order catalogs. You could write to Montgomery Ward and say, send me your house catalog. And you could write to Sears and send me your house catalog. And if you really wanted to go a distance, you could write to Gordon Van Tine in Davenport, Iowa, or Aladdin Company in Bay City, Michigan, and say, hey, send me your catalog. And then you could study all the catalogs and the pricing schemes and the designs, and you could pick the house of your dreams and order it.
Now, my worry would be, you know, sometimes even today when you order stuff by mail, you maybe end up with a lower quality product. Were these houses lower grade or flimsier than something you might have just had constructed locally?
No, they actually were extremely sturdily built, well-designed, top-quality materials. So you would not have been disappointed in the quality of your house. And your house would still be standing happily today and be much better made than anything that's going up currently.
You're close to our border here with Wisconsin. Do you come up to Wisconsin to do some mail-order house hunting?
Oh, you bet. You know, for years, Wisconsin has been my playground. My son and grandchildren live up near the Twin Cities in Baldwin, Wisconsin, on a farm. So I am always traipsing through Wisconsin, and it's my great pleasure to traipse on different routes every time I travel. It's also true that I've been invited to lecture in towns like Lake Geneva and Racine and Kenosha, so I have gone in those directions to actually give lectures on mail-order houses. Sometimes I take the ferry across the lake, so then I get to drive up in those towns. Much of my on-the-road time in Wisconsin has been spent with my friend and colleague in Hartford, Wisconsin. Marilyn Raska contacted me soon after I began doing this research. I got an email from her. She said, I live in Hartford, Wisconsin, and I live in a Sears Mitchell model, and I want to know more. And so I went up. She invited me up to see the house, and she got as fascinated by it as I am, and so thanks to Marilyn, Hartford is the only town in Wisconsin where a complete documented survey has yet been done. And she and I, when we spend time together, after we're done playing with her cats, we hit the road and we say, okay, what town haven't we been to yet? Let's go to Beaver Dam. And so we've done a lot of traipsing around Central Wisconsin together.
And were we big fans of mail order houses here in Wisconsin?
I would say you're medium fans of mail order houses there in Wisconsin. I have not done complete documented surveys anywhere except for Hartford. But you know, compared to Elgin, which has 300 mail order houses, in Janesville, I've come across about 65 and about 45 in Beloit, 30 in Racine, 35 in Racine, and about 30 in Kenosha. Now, those are not complete surveys. Remember that. Remember
sure.
that. I have small numbers for Milwaukee and Madison. It's not because they aren't there. It's because I haven't looked. So I would say that your medium fans up there, almost every little town I've ever gone through has at least one mail order house.
As we wrap up, do you have, maybe this is too hard a question, I don't know. Do you have a favorite model from the different companies of a mail order house, the one you really love to find?
Oh, I have, depending on how you define favorite models, okay, favorite models are usually arts and crafts design bungalows. That's my favorite architectural style, okay? So a model that I would like to live in is one category, and there's about 5 or 6 or 7 or 10 favorite models from different companies there. Favorite models in terms of rare ones that I've never seen yet. That's another whole list of favorite models that I look for every place I go.
Fantastic.
So you're right, it's not a simple question.
Well, Rebecca, thank you so much and happy hunting.
Well, thank you.
Rebecca Hunter is an architectural historian. She joined us to talk about mail order homes. She's been hunting down these houses in several states, including Illinois and Wisconsin, for more than 20 years. Her books include Putting Sears Homes on the Map and Mail Order Homes. Right now, Governor Scott Walker's decision to pledge billions of dollars to lure tech giant Foxconn to Wisconsin is shaping the debate on economic development in this year's race for governor. As Laurel White reports, Governor Walker won't rule out more Foxconn-style deals in the future, while Democrat Tony Evers says the governor is taking the state down a slippery slope.
Over the course of the past couple years, Governor Scott Walker said repeatedly that something like the state's deal with Foxconn doesn't come around very often.
This once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for Wisconsin and this new Foxconn...
This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for Wisconsin.
But Foxconn's status as a once-in-a-lifetime deal didn't last very long. It was only about 6 months later when the governor decided to pull out the Foxconn playbook in an attempt to keep consumer products company Kimberly-Clark from closing two plants in Wisconsin.
This is a large industry that has a multiple ripple effect out there. And I think in this case, we're looking when something has such a large impact, we're willing to put a significant offer on the table.
Since that proposal, the governor has insisted that Foxconn-style deals aren't going to be his go-to economic strategy in the future, despite what it may look like. Kimberly-Clark, he says, is special, like Foxconn.
The reason why we looked at Kimberly-Clark in a similar way that we did at Foxconn is these are transformational, industry-driven careers.
Timothy Bartik is a senior economist at the W.E. Upjohn Institute for Employment Research. He says the governor might have trouble being as selective as he wants to be with incentive deals now that he's set a precedent. Bartik says incentives are like potato chips.
When it comes to incentives, you can't hand out just one.
Bartik has studied economic incentive packages all over the country. He says Foxconn got 10 times the incentives businesses usually get.
You know, essentially with Foxconn, they kind of threw out all the old rules.
Bartik says Wisconsin doesn't have enough money to keep handing out deals like Foxconn's. He says the state needs to be very picky about who qualifies for incentives. Governor Walker says he's doing that. He points out that Bonton, which had corporate offices in Milwaukee, announced plans to close stores and cut thousands of jobs. In that situation, state government did not step in. But the governor's Democratic opponent, State School Superintendent Tony Evers, argues Walker's deal with Foxconn was motivated by politics, not economic development. Evers says he has a different vision for how to spur Wisconsin's economy.
We are going to move away from the idea that somehow we need to throw a Hail Mary pass every 4 years in order to make economy grow in the state of Wisconsin.
Evers wants to eliminate the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation, which approved the state's contract with Foxconn. He also says he wants to do more to keep state money in local communities by setting up loan programs for small businesses and startups.
Economic development in the state of Wisconsin should be a 72-county solution, not a southeast Wisconsin versus the rest of the state.
Evers won't commit one way or another to the Kimberly-Clark deal. He says he needs more details, but he says offers like it set a bad precedent.
Well, it certainly gives us pause, right? That if it's Kimberly-Clark, then it's somebody else and somebody else.
Evers says incentive deals like Foxconn and Kimberly-Clark can give the government too much power to pick winners and losers in business. Walker says they're evidence that he'll do whatever it takes when it comes to jobs. Whether future companies get the same treatment could hinge on who's governor for the next 4 years, leaving voters to choose who they think will give them the biggest bang for their buck. Laurel White, Wisconsin Public Radio.
First, we face a lot of big choices in our lives. Get married or not, and to whom? Have kids? Move to a strange new place for a job? Start a new radio show? Change a business strategy? These can all be tough choices. There are a lot of variables, and it's hard to predict the outcomes when we make a big change like that. Our next guest has some good news. He says there are strategies and ways of thinking that can help us weigh the options and make better decisions. Stephen Johnson is the host of the PBS series How We Got to Now and the podcast American Innovations. He is the author of 11 books, including his latest, Farsighted, How We Make the Decisions That Matter the Most. Stephen, thanks for joining us today. Oh, we've lost Stephen. He was on his way into his studio, I think. You can join in, by the way, at 800-642-1234. Have you made a big decision like this in your life? How did you weigh the different options? Be interested in hearing your story. Did you make a list of pros and cons? Did you end up ignoring that list, or did it work for you? What kind of strategies do you use when you make a big decision in your life, whether to move, get married, have kids, make a big change of any sort like that? Tell us your story at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Hypothetically, we'll have our guest on in just a moment. Let's see. It looks like we may have him in the studio now. Stephen, hi. Welcome to the show.
Hey, how's it going?
Well, good. So we're not just talking about decisions here, like about what to have for lunch, you know, the little stuff, which cereal to buy. You're looking at big life-changing decisions that are going to shape our lives for years to come. What's the difference in our brains and in the ways we think between those kinds of decisions?
Well, you know, it's interesting. There's been a lot written over the last 10, 15 years ago about our kind of instinctive brain and the kinds of decisions that we make in you know, kind of a flash judgment, our gut decisions and things like that. And those, it's fascinating, the research on that, the brain science on that is fascinating. But I think if we look back on our lives and we think about the decisions that we make that really end up changing things for us, like the choices you were just talking about, should I take a new job? Or if it's a business decision, should I launch a new product in a completely new market? Those are the decisions that really end up shaping, you know, the course of our careers or of our lives. And so I wanted with this book to go and look at what we understood about those decisions in terms of the science, really. Like, what do we know about how to make them, and can we actually get better? Can we teach people to get better at them?
And you look at a huge range of decisions, from Charles Darwin deciding whether or not to get married to the Obama administration deciding whether to go ahead with the attack that ultimately killed Osama bin Laden, and took lessons out of those things. I want to start with that Darwin example. This is something a lot of people might have done. He did the traditional pro on one side of the list, con on the other. Is that a good strategy for us to use?
Yeah, the book kind of starts with that story because it's so funny. It's like right in the middle of Darwin, you know, coming up with the theory of natural selection in 1838. In his scientific notebooks, he devotes two kind of facing pages to a pros and cons list. He calls it kind of not marry and marry, and he writes down all the different options. It's very funny. I kind of reproduce the list in the book. It's very funny to read now. It's a little dated. But one of the reasons I started with that is that's the one technique that most people do learn, right? The mm-hmm. pros and cons list. And so in a way, it's been, you know, if Darwin was doing it almost 200 years ago, we really haven't advanced a lot. And in fact, there are a lot of other techniques. And part of the problem with the pros and cons list is, by definition, you're looking at one alternative, right? Like, should I do this or not? And sometimes, you know, we call it a whether or not decision. And there's a lot of research that shows that there's a guy named Paul Nutt who's done a number of different studies of decisions in a kind of a business context. And he looked at the way people made their decisions. Did they have a process? And one of the things he found is that it was very unusual for people to have a part, a stage in the decision-making process where they actually took out time to try and come up with other alternatives, right? They were just looking at, again, at a whether or not decision. Should I do this or not? And in fact, those decisions, without that stage of exploring other alternatives, ended up being, you know, only 29, 30% of them were ultimately considered to be a success. But if people took time at the beginning, this is what I call in Farsighted, the mapping stage of a decision process. If they took time to actually explore other alternatives, come up with other potential paths they might take, they were more likely than not to be happy with the outcome.
So we limit ourselves if we think of most of these decisions as yes or no, A or B. If we don't step back and say, are these really the only two alternatives?
You know, in a sense, there's a kind of macro way of describing what I'm arguing for in the book, which is that whenever you face one of these truly complex choices, I call them full spectrum decisions, like they just involve all these different elements, in one choice. What we want to do is go through these exercises that challenge our assumptions, that challenge our initial assessment of the situation, expand all our alternatives, because it's in the nature of these things to be so complex that we can't perceive them all. And we go into them with the kind of too much confidence, too much assumption that we understand the situation. So you want to, at least initially, in a sense, you want to be, people always talk about wanting to be decisive. But actually, in a way, what you want to do at the beginning is hold that decisiveness in check for a while you work through all the potential options on the table.
I want to talk about this in two different settings, a group and then an individual. Looking at a group setting, you say that one way to help consider those different options and maybe punch a hole in that initial, what seems like a good decision, but you haven't thought it through, is to have a diverse group of decision makers. Why is that?
You know, this is one of the recurring findings in group psychology and behavioral economics and behavioral psychology over the last 20 years or so, that diverse groups make more creative, more insightful, come up with more creative and insightful solutions to problems. And that diversity can be measured in a lot of different ways. There's gender diversity, there's, you know, ethnic diversity, but there's also diversity of expertise, intellectual background, profession. When you put a group of people together in a room who all think in similar ways and who all have the same background and the same kind of cognitive styles, they end up falling prey to all of the problems of kind of groupthink and overconfidence and confirmation bias and so on. They come to an agreement too quickly. And that can make for, you know, a socially comfortable atmosphere, but it doesn't always lead to the best decisions. You need those different perspectives to propose new alternatives or to suggest, you know, these flaws in the decision you're looking at that you might not otherwise see from the vantage point that you're taking. So diversifying the people around you is one of the key steps that you want to take in making a choice like this.
So that's great for a group or a team decision. Now, what if this is a decision that's just me making it? I can't be that diverse. I'm just one person. How can I take advantage of that idea of different viewpoints in one human brain?
Well, yes, right. You want to just have one brain in there. You don't want to have multiple brains
Exactly. Inside
the same skull. So the part of this is there's kind of a second phase that I talk about in the book, which is the predicting phase, right? And almost every complex long-term decision is a decision that involves some level of prediction, right? You're choosing this because you think in 6 months or a year or 5 years that this outcome will be better. But that's a prediction, and humans, as we know, are very bad at prediction, particularly with complex kind of long-term situations. So part of the work here, if you're just making the decision on your own, is to force yourself to, in a sense, make multiple predictions. It's really almost a storytelling exercise, right? So when you're looking at a choice in your life, you're trying to decide whether to take this new job, and you've gotten all excited about it, and you think, well, this is going to be great, and you've implicitly told yourself a story about the future. You're like, this is going to be so great. I'm going to be so happy. The people are going to be fantastic. The pay is going to be good. All the things that you're excited about. At that stage, right as you're about to kind of pull the trigger on that decision, One technique that you can use is, well, it's this technique developed by this psychologist named Gary Klein, and it's called a pre-mortem. And a pre-mortem is basically where you force yourself to tell the story of the choice you're about to make that you're so excited about. Only this story, in 5 years, it turns out to be a catastrophe. And your job is to tell the story of how it went wrong. And there's kind of interesting psychological research in this that apparently if you just ask people, do you see any flaws with this particular choice? They'll say, no, it looks great. It's fantastic. I'm so excited. But if you force them to actually tell the kind of negative worst case scenario kind of story, they do perceive flaws that they wouldn't otherwise see. They might still end up making the choice, but they're more... They, in a sense, have diversified their perspective, you know, by themselves, by forcing themselves to tell this kind of negative outcome story.
Talking to Stephen Johnson, his new book is Farsighted, How We Make the Decisions That Matter the Most. Well, speaking of storytelling, Stephen, one of your pieces of advice is read more novels, and that's going to help us be better decision makers. Do I have that right?
Yeah, well, it's funny. You know, there's a lot of science in this book, a lot of different kinds of science. There's a lot of neuroscience, there's a lot of psychology, and so on. But one of the things I really wrestled with is, you know, every complex choice like this is unique, right? That's what makes it so challenging. You know, it's a unique constellation of forces that come together in your life that will never be exactly repeated in anybody else's life. And so the question is, you know, how can we get better at these kinds of choices? Because each one is kind of singular. It's a snowflake. It's a fingerprint, right? It's never to be repeated. So what are the universal lessons, right, that we can apply to these unique situations? And I think what science can teach us is, you know, these are the things that we've learned about how to see these situations with more clarity and how to expose ourselves to new perspectives on them. But literature also, I think, gives us something else. So I talk a lot in the book about Middlemarch, you know, the great 19th century novel, George Eliot's kind of masterpiece. And there are a number of decisions in that book that the characters make. And Eliot, as a novelist, has this extraordinary ability to show us the decision in all of its complexity and show us this kind of interior vista into the deciding mind at work trying to wrestle with a choice like that. And I believe, and I think there's some research to back this up, that that's one of the great gifts of literature, is that we get to watch these kind of parallel lives running and see that kind of interior landscape. And by watching somebody else make a choice like that and watching multiple people in multiple novels make choices like that, it's in a sense kind of practice. It's a rehearsal for the kinds of choices that we make in the real world.
So is decision-making, and again, this big-picture decision-making, not the, you know, spur-of-the-moment type stuff, is decision-making a skill that we as individuals can get better at over time?
I do believe so. And in fact, the more I have researched this, and I've been working on this book on and off for 8 years now, appropriately enough for a book about long-term thinking, I think that complex decision-making should be a required course in every high school. Because, one, I believe there is a lot of material out there now that we can use and that it can be taught. It is a skill that we can improve. You know, we'll never get to perfection with it, but we can get better at it. And if you think of all the things you learned in high school that you don't use anymore, you know, that you never really used after you took the test, that decision-making would be an actual skill that would be useful to you no matter what you did with your career, with your life. That being able to make complex decisions more skillfully would be something that you would use, you know, for the rest of your life at those important moments. And along the way in such a class, you would read novels and you would talk about the utilitarian philosophers and you would talk about neuroscience and cognitive psychology and you would learn a whole range of different interesting fields, but it would all be in the service of a skill that would be applicable you know, in your adult life going forward.
Now, something I'm really good at is postponing decisions. Uh-huh. Is there a point, even if we go through this whole process and we're just on the fence, is there a way to overcome indecision?
Yeah, it's funny. I don't talk about that nearly as much in the book as I probably should have, because it's come up in the book tour a couple of times. So much of what I'm talking about is being deliberative with your decisions. And you're right, there are people who are too deliberative, right?
You mentioned Hamlet in the book at one point.
Yeah, I think that the way to think about it is, as I've kind of alluded to, In the book, I divide it up into these three phases that you want to go through. You want to have a process, and there's a mapping phase and a predicting phase and then a deciding phase. And in the book, I talk about techniques to use in each of those phases. I think that that for people who tend to be too instinctual and going with their gut, the phases can help you slow down. For people who tend to be too indecisive, I think the phases can actually be useful as well, in the sense that you define a period and say, okay, I'm going to spend 1 week on mapping, 1 week on predicting, and 1 week on deciding, and then I'll pull the trigger. And that will give you a little bit more kind of clarity and kind of closure to the process that you might not otherwise have.
And can you talk to us about dealing with those, you referenced Donald Rumsfeld, the known unknowns. Like, before you have kids, you don't know what life with having kids is like. Before you move from the East to the West Coast, as you tried, you talk about in the book, you don't know really what it's like day to day to live there. How do you try to factor in those things that you just can't know until you take the plunge?
Yeah, I mean, that's one place where diversity really helps, like just talking to different people who will point out things that just had never occurred to you. There's a great quote in the book from Thomas Schelling, the Nobel laureate, who says, the one thing you can never do, no matter how brilliant you are, is write up a list of things that would never occur to you. And in a sense, by diversifying the pool of people around you, giving you advice, that offers you an opportunity to kind of see those, known unknowns, or even the unknown unknowns, which are the scarier variation. But also the storytelling, too. I mean, there's a technique that's related to the premortem we just talked about called scenario planning. And that's where you try and tell multiple stories about the outcome you're kind of thinking about. And one of the directives in that, one of the exercises is you tell three stories for the decision you're looking at. One where things go really well, one where things go really poorly, and one where things get really weird. And that exercise of trying to imagine what that weird scenario would be, that is one way to kind of trick your mind into seeing some of those known unknowns, or anticipating some of the things that you might not have otherwise anticipated.
I'll start trying to think of those weird scenarios. Stephen, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the conversation.
Stephen Johnson is the author of the new book, Farsighted: How We Make the Decisions That Matter the Most. He joined us with some tips and strategies to help make those decisions. And there's still time for you to share your experiences along those lines. Let us know over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tell us about a big decision you've made or you are making and how you weighed it. Did you reach out to other people as your brain trust to get different perspectives? Did you make that pro and con list that Charles Darwin did before he got married? Let us know on the Ideas Network Facebook page. As reported in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, there's new data out from the bulk candy company CandyStore.com looking at our favorite Halloween candies. It's a little early. It's the beginning of October, but I think they do this every year around this time. I don't know if it's the most scientific study in the world, but it's something. So nationwide, the number one candy on the list is Skittles. We're a little different here in Wisconsin, though. Our number one favorite candy is, according again to this one company, the Butterfinger. That Butterfinger doesn't even make the top 10 list nationally. Number two in Wisconsin, Starburst. Number three, the Hot Tamale. Now, the nationwide top 10, as I mentioned, Skittles, number one, M&M's, I could see that, Snickers, Reese's Peanut Butter Cups locks in at number four. Now, that's the number one in my household, and there's always the quandary every year when we buy Halloween candy to give away. Do we get the peanut butter cups so we have the advantage of being able to eat them, or do we avoid them like the plague, knowing that we will eat too many of them? Let us know your favorite candy, or the one you avoid or hated getting as a kid. You could tweet us at Central Time WPR. Stick around. There's more to come on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time.